Okay, thanks, John. I'm looking around, and I see that it's quite a mixed bag with certainly some string theorists, some kinetic metaphysicists, some real physicists as well. Thanks for coming, Doug. Now, some of you have heard parts of most of this talk before, and I apologize to those, and please feel free to leave whenever you feel so inclined. Okay, so what I'd like to do is tell you a bit about some things I've been working on really for 5, 6, 7 years, trying to develop at least some theoretical framework to access non-Fermi liquid phases of two-dimensional itinerant electrons. And the take-home message, perhaps not such a nice one for the ADS-CMP program, is that the technique which seems to work in this regard is the technique of partons, where one takes, you know, the basic electron and breaks it into a product of other fields, maybe a bosonic times a fermionic field, or as we'll think about, the product of three fermionic fields. And then the trick is going to be basically gluing back together these parton degrees of freedom to reconstruct the electron. And that can be done approximately using a gauge theory. It can also be done in another way, which is also approximate, using Gutzwiller wave functions, where one just basically does a projection back into the physical Hilbert space. Okay, so I'll show how this parton approach can give us access to at least certain types of Bose metals. And moreover, that these Bose metals give one a possible pathway to access electron non-Fermi liquid states. Then I'll focus on a particular Bose metal, the D-wave Bose metal, and talk a little bit about how one would try to access this in the continuum, not putting the model on a lattice. And it's here that one perhaps might be able to make some contact with a future ADS, a CFD type approaches, but you know, I'm certainly no expert, as you know. And then the last part of the talk, I'll focus on, you know, the bread and butter of a condensed matter theorist, which is the lattice Hamiltonians and energetics, really trying to see, you know, and establish that particular, you know, fairly reasonable looking Hamiltonians have ground states which are of the type that one is interested in trying to access or describe. So in this case, lattice Hamiltonians which might have Bose metal or non-Fermi liquid metal ground states. Okay, my collaborators, and I've been ongoing for a while, they said, so Ryan Mishmash, Ryan's up here, he's a graduate student at UCSB, expert in MRG. Hongcheng Jiang's a KITP postdoc, I don't see him here. He's also a DMRG expert. Matt Block just graduated from UCSB, and he was a variation Monte Carlo guy, and he's now got a postdoc at University of Kentucky with Ribu Kaul, whom some of you might know. Donna Sheng has played an absolute central role, and she's also a numerical physicist with DMRG and exact ionization calculations. And finally, but certainly not least, Leszek Malchinich, who's on the faculty at Caltech, who's really been the leader in this entire thrust of activity. And so I want to give him special mention. So what is a non-Fermi liquid metal? Well, one can think about that question for a while, and at least I realize that I don't know what the answer is. And so I think my best definition is a non-Fermi liquid is not a Fermi liquid. So as long as one knows what a Fermi liquid is, one can define a non-Fermi liquid as something that it isn't. That may be at this stage the best we can do, and that's quite powerful actually, because the Fermi liquid is a very very well characterized phase of matter. It has, you know, very nice and structure. So let me just remind you, a two-dimensional Fermi liquid, it's convenient to look at the momentum distribution function, the probability of finding an electron in one's, let's say, interacting electron system at momentum k, and one can plot that momentum distribution function as a function of k. And the defining characteristic of a Fermi liquid is that there is a jump discontinuity in the momentum distribution function. And at some particular wave vector kf, And as one looks around various directions, let's say in the two-dimensional Brillouin zone, that Fermi wave vector traces out a surface that needn't be circular, even though I've drawn it that way. And the really defining characteristic of a Fermi liquid is not only this jump discontinuity, but the surface that it sweeps out encloses a volume which is set by the total density of fermions. And this is a property of the free Fermi gas, but it's also a property of the interacting Fermi liquid. And it is actually kind of a remarkable a fact, indeed, because the discontinuity in the Fermi surface here dictates the long-distance behavior of correlation functions, for example, the fermionic Green's function, which oscillates with the power law decay, oscillating at Fermi wave at kF. So that's a long-distance property, an infrared property. On the other hand, this Lunger's theorem, which tells one about enclosing the fixed number of fermions, the total number of fermions, is really an ultraviolet property, right? I mean, it's the entire Fermi C, which is enclosed within the Fermi C, the class of electrons. That's a Fermi liquid. Various possibilities for 2D non-Fermi liquid. I mean, if one has a theory for such a phase, one can try to characterize it. It might have, for example, a singular surface, like a Fermi surface, but rather than having a jump discontinuity, has a weaker singularity at some wave vector kF. It might have a dominant singular surface in momentum space whose area does not encompass the total number of electrons. And there's issues, for example, in the high-temperature superconductors. Is the volume inside the Fermi C 1 minus x, which naively would be all the electrons, or is it x? Here, x is the doping concentration away from the half-filled, more insulating state. One might imagine other situations with Fermi surfaces have arcs. I mean, I think it'd be a little bit hard to imagine something like this, although it's possible that the jump discontinuity could vanish as one comes to the end, although presumably one has singular behavior over here. It's just higher order singularities. Okay, so since we don't really know what they are, you know, it's not necessarily so easy to try to access them. But when desperate, one takes desperate measures, and so that's what we'll do. And we'll try to do something which, for someone who, like me, who likes field theory, goes a little bit against the grain, which is to construct wave functions. But wave functions have a venerable history in condensed matter physics, and you know, two of our resounding successes are really the theories of a wave function, BCS, on the one hand, and of course Laughlin's wave function in the quantum Hall effect. And what we would like to try to do for these putative non-Fermi liquid phases is to try to construct wave functions using this parton approach. Okay, well first let me just remind you about the wave function, since I'm now talking about wave functions for Fermi liquids and for the free Fermi gas. Of course, the free Fermi gas, using the wave function, this is the determinant built from the plane waves that live inside the Fermi C. And it's useful to sometimes think about this free fermion determinant, not in momentum space, where it's utterly trivial, but in real space, which is actually very complicated. So in particular, if you look at a quantity here, which I've defined as a single particle function in quotes, where one freezes the positions of all but one coordinate of the electrons, and then looks at the function phi of r as one varies the remaining coordinate, like if you want like the coordinate of the test particle. And what this does is it exposes a rather simple cross-section of the very non-trivial nodal structure in the free fermion determinant. What's plotted here is taken from David Sepoli, who's a quantum Monte Carlo expert who thinks a lot about sine structures of fermionic wave functions. And what's plotted is a set of lines which demarcate the boundaries between where this quantity phi is positive and where phi is negative. So maybe it's too small to see, but there are a bunch of points here, which is where the fermions are sitting. And of course, due to Pauli exclusion principle, these lines have to pass through these fermions. And here's the test particle. But actually, what one has here is some sort of statistical mechanical problem of lines. And these lines are critical. We know that because the fermion-Green's function is a power law in space. So these lines are critical at long scales, but they also encode the ultraviolet short-range structure that one has in the Fermi surface as well. So it's interesting to think about. It's just a circular Fermi surface in two dimensions. That's what this is, yeah. I mean, this must be periodic boundary conditions.
How are the R's chosen?
Well, the R's are chosen to be typical configurations which are selected by mod psi squared. You know, so that you could put all the particles on one side, but that's a very rare configuration. The wave function would be very small. So they basically just move the particles around, letting them live in the regions where mod psi squared is largest, and then they just stop and then move that test particle around. Yeah, so you can, the ensemble of lines can be defined as the ensemble given by the weighted by mod psi squared, where you're moving the second and up the nth particle around. Okay, what about a wave function for an interacting Fermi liquid? Well, what's usually done, and that's not always the case, but most of the time, is that people retain this very complicated nodal structure, which is in the free Fermi C, and modify the amplitude of the wave function. And usually that's done for some physical reason, for example, to try to keep the particles apart from one another if they have a strong repulsive interaction, like in helium-3 or electrons, whether there's a strong on-site U, for example, one would want to put in what's sometimes called a Jastrow factor, which is just a factor out front which affects the amplitude. And it's a non-negative factor. And it usually is taken to depend on some function of the difference between all pairs of electrons. And this function U of R is taken as a variational parameter to minimize the energy of some Hamiltonian that one might be interested in. So one can try to do that for helium-3, for example. But this is a wave function for an interacting Fermi liquid, which is surely overly simplified, because there's no reason that an interacting fermion wave function, even if it's in a Fermi liquid phase, should have identical nodal structure to a free Fermi gas. But it's, in some sense, the nodal structure of a free Fermi gas is very special, right, as I was mentioning, in giving one this Fermi surface and giving one both the Luttinger's volume theorem for the Fermi C, as well as a long distance behavior of the correlators. What about this parton approach to non-Fermi liquid wave functions? Okay, so this is partons, and I'm sure there's a long history of doing this, but in condensed matter physics, it's been going on for 20 years, maybe longer. But where one might, for example, take the electron operator and decompose it in terms of a spinless boson, which we can say carries a charge. It doesn't actually matter how you assign the charge, but think of the boson as carrying the charge, and the spinon F, which is a neutral fermion, carries the spin of the electron. And so in a mean field theory, one does something which looks totally absurd, and which is in some sense totally absurd, which is one treats the spinons and the bosons as completely independent. One just liberates them and says, let them behave as free particles with their own free particle Hamiltonian, HF plus HB. Find the ground state of those free particle Hamiltonians, psi F and psi B. Now, what one has done, though, is enlarge the Hilbert space. One has twice as many particles as one started. And so this is not physically relevant to the electron problem, so one has to fix up that mean field theory. And as I say, one way to do that field theoretically is with a gauge theory, which I won't so much talk about. Another way to do it is to brute force in the wave function, glue the fermionic and bosonic partons back together. So one is then projecting back into the physical Hilbert space, basically taking the coordinates of the bosons and identifying them and replacing them by the coordinates of the spin-up and spin-down electrons, which enter into into the side F, the wavefront of the spin-ons. So at least one has thereby constructed a wave function which is a legitimate wave function for a system of fermions. It lives in the right Hilbert space. Well, is it a reasonable thing to do? Well, we can see whether or not, well, I can now offer several reasons why this might be a reasonable thing to do. By looking at both Fermi and putative non-Fermi liquids via partons. But let me put the spin-ons in a filled Fermi C, the determinant for the upspins, the determinant for the downspin electrons. And to construct a Fermi liquid, what we have to do is we have to condense the boson. So a Fermi liquid wave function within this parton approach, which is the same as what I was showing with the Jastrow approach, is to take a free fermion, a wave function, and multiply it by a Bose-Einstein condensate of these bosons. And for example, this Jastrow factor that I had before describes a superfluid phase of bosons. In fact, one can use these Jastrow factors of this form for trying to understand helium-4, and that was something that Bill McMillan did many years ago, maybe more than 50 years, trying to do Monte Carlo on these Jastrow-type wave functions for helium-4. If one wants to understand things in terms of operators, basically what one is doing is one is taking the electron, which is written as a part of the boson and the spin-on, and one is condensing the boson. So one can then get away with approximately replacing that by a constant, and then the electron and the spin-on become the same as one another. If one were using a gauge theory, what would be happening here when one condenses the boson is one would be Higgsing out the gauge field. Perhaps in this case it would be a U1 gauge field, which would be the glue that tries to bind them together, and one would gap out the gauge field, condense the boson, which does that, and then recover just a theory for a fermion, for the electrons. And in this case, it would be a Fermi liquid, at least in the situation. So a non-Fermi liquid within this parton approach, one could imagine trying to construct a wave function for bosons, which is uncondensed, so-called Bose metal. And if one had such a phase, such a wave function, one can then construct a non-Fermi liquid wave function by multiplying a free fermion determinant of the spin-ons times a Bose metal of the bosons. And so this would be some way to construct a non-Fermi liquid metal. Again, it's a product, in this construction, a product of Fermi C in an uncondensed Bose metal. And this is something, trying to construct and understand theories of Bose metals has been something I've been interested in and trying to do for about 15 years, maybe longer. And the main motivation, ultimately, was to try to understand non-Fermi liquid phases in this way, using partons. So what is a Bose metal? Well, Bose metal could be a number of different things, but in the context of what I'm talking about, I think these are reasonable definitions. So it's a stable zero temperature liquid phase of bosons that is not a superfluid. So it has bosons moving around, they're itinerant, but they don't condense. The Green's function for the bosons, which is the Fourier transform of the momentum distribution function, will have a Powell law decay and will oscillate at some wave vector, kind of like a Fermi wave vector, but I'm going to call it a Bose wave vector, AB. And so the momentum distribution function then, which is the Fourier transform of this Bose metal Green's function, is singular in momentum space, and it's singular at these momenta, case of B. So what one might have, and what we'll see one does have in particular models that we can look at later, is that the bosonic momentum distribution function looks something like this. It has a maybe an increasing singularity at some wave vector and then falls off like this. And so this is to be contrasted with the momentum distribution function in a Fermi system, which looks like this and then has a jump discontinuity and goes down to zero. And these Fermi wave vectors, case of B, will trace out a closed curve in momentum space. Basically, each Fermi wave vector, Bose wave vector, can be access by looking in real space in a particular direction, looking at the parallel decay, the dominant parallel decay in that direction, and pulling out a wave vector k sub b, and then rotating around in real space. And so that wave vector will necessarily sweep out a closed curve in a two-dimensional Brown zone.
Why
did I say angular dependent anomalous dimension? Just to be general, and in the cases we're looking at, it is the case. I mean, it's
some sort of lattice effect.
No, there's not a lattice effect. Yeah, I mean, ultimately you may need on a lattice to get this phase, but it doesn't have a simple interpretation in terms of the total number of bosons, although it's something to do with that. In these Parkov constructions, there are actually two dominant surfaces, one really strong surface and another one which is weaker. And if one looks at the sort of convolution of those two surfaces, one could reconstruct a surface which encodes or encloses the total number of bosons.
Oh, the number of bosons measured. The bosons are carrying charge?
The bosons are carrying charge. It is just charge carrying in this boson. Yeah, so somewhere, hidden in there is a singular surface that you could construct, but which would enclose a number of bosons, but it's not the, it wouldn't be the dominant singular surface.
Why do you draw G monatomically for KB, for example?
Why did I have it coming up there? Because actually in one dimension, if you look at a one-dimensional Ludinger liquid and look at the bosonic Ludinger liquid and look at the boson Green's function, you actually have this behavior for the momentum distribution function. Whereas in a fermion system, it comes down in the Ludinger liquid and has a singularity like this. It's due to the long-time decay of the fermion and boson Green's function, the fact that the fermion and Green's function, let's say in one dimension, falls off as sine kx over x, and is odd in x goes to minus x, whereas for the boson, it's even. And so if you just sit and do the Fourier transform of those. For the fermions, the momentum distribution function cannot go above one. I mean, you can't have more than one fermion. The bosons, this could get arbitrarily big, I suppose. So, if you could put more bosons in one momentum state, right, than one, I mean, you could. You'd think you'd have something here. Well, okay, so this state is very different than the superfluid phase, and so we'll have lattice models in a moment which have two dominant phases. One is a Bose metal, which looks like this, and one is a superfluid in which you get a huge peak at zero momentum.
Is the charge density equal to the volume?
Yeah, okay, so that's not precise. No, it isn't. But as I say, there is another less singular surface which would be hard to detect, probably. And if you sort of convolute those two surfaces in a particular way, you get a third surface which does enclose the total number of bosons. In the Parkov construction, we'll see the boson is broken into a product of two fermions. And each of those fermions has a Fermi surface which encloses the total number of particles. But then the bosonic Green's function is a convolution of those two fermion Green's functions. And there's particular surfaces in doing that convolution which are singular, which are most singular. And it's basically where the two, when you have these two Fermi surfaces, it's where the Fermi velocities on those two Fermi surfaces are, let's say, anti-parallel to one another. Right? Those define very special wave vectors, which are used to construct this singular surface.
Should we think of this as being near some charge density wave?
No.
So I shouldn't think of
this as something that wasn't a function. No, because it's. As you'll see when you, maybe not sharp, but when you vary parameters around in some particular Hamiltonian, this wave vector moves around. and with a fixed density. So it's not an incipient CDW. I mean, if anything, it's sort of an incipient attempt to try to condense the bosons at finite momenta, right? So there's a peak here we're trying to condense, but it doesn't. bosons don't. Yeah, I don't even know if it would be possible to describe a physically reasonable state in which the bosons actually condense along a line in momentum space. I don't know, maybe Leon can chime in on that.
No.
It's not reasonable?
I will not chime in.
Oh, okay. Someone was trying to do so. It was Astrian and Sentinel that were trying to do something like that, I think, maybe. Anyway, maybe it wasn't that. Okay, so let me give one precedent for using partons to construct non-Fermi liquids, which is the quantum Hall effect. I mean, everything was done in our field in the quantum Hall effect, all types of approaches. And so if you take a half-fill Landau level, the system is not in an incompressible quantum Hall state, I mean, empirically, experimentally. And there's a beautiful wave function called the composite Fermi liquid wave function, which was sort of put forward by Halperin, Patrick Lee, and the Nick Reed, which is a product of a Laughlin state for bosons at nu equals 1/2 times a filled Fermi C, times a filled Fermi C, right? So it's a compressible state, and so this is, you know, an example of this parton construction, even though I don't think it was necessarily viewed that way at the time, that C is B times F, and so you want to write the wave function for the electrons as a wave function for the bosons, nu equals 1/2 here, and a wave function for the fermions. Now, this is all good, but in our situation, it's not going to be directly useful because the composite Fermi liquid breaks time reversal invariants, and we're interested in time reversal invariant systems. In particular, I mean, you can see it breaks time reversal invariants because Z is a complex coordinate. But let me just point out one feature of the nu equals 1/2 Laughlin wave function for bosons is that when you take the test particle in this single particle function and you take it around any of the other particles, you pick up 4 pi of phase. And so this wave function has 2 particle correlations, which is dx squared minus y squared plus I dxy. And it's not a paired state in any sense, but in the Laughlin wave function, whenever 2 particles get close together, they are essentially rotating around one another with 2 units of angular momentum. Okay, so one strategy to construct a time reversal invariant non-Fermi liquid, and this is really the route that we took historically some number of years ago, was to construct a boson wave function with d wave 2 particle correlations, but not d plus id, let's say, rather than that, correlations with dxy. So for a real pair correlation. One second. And then if such a wave function is thereby constructed, one takes that boson wave function and multiplies by the filled Fermi C, just as one does with a composite Fermi liquid, and gets some sort of non-Fermi liquid metal, which would have dxy. In fact, in this case, it would have dxy singlet 2 electron correlations. So we call this a d-wave metal. Actually,
So do I understand correctly that once time reversal symmetry is broken, the nodal structure is actually very, very different?
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, so very good point. So when time reversal invariance is broken, the wave function is necessarily complex. And if one defines this quantity that I was talking about, where one's going to move the test particle around in the two-dimensional plane, if one has a complex wave function, in order to get the wave function to vanish, one has to tune both the real and the imaginary parts to 0. So generally, you'll have isolated points where the wave function vanishes, and those are, in Laughlin's wave functions, those are the vortices, which are located on the other electrons. But whereas in the time reversal invariant situation, the wave function can be taken real, and then you only have one function, which you want to tune to 0, so you just have to move in one direction. in the two-dimensional XY plane, and you'll hit these nodal lines where the wave function changes sign. And you know, it's really this which makes two-dimensional time reversal invariant fermions much, much, much harder than two-dimensional, you know, fermions in a magnetic field or non-time reversal invariant fermions. Because all the techniques of flux tube attachment, Chern-Simons theory, you know, all relying on these zeros. Well, but partons isn't. Maybe that's why it's useful. Are there a thought? Okay, so how can we construct such a boson wave function with a DXY two particle correlations? Well, we can just take the hint again from Laughlin. So at nu equals 1/2, we can reconstruct Laughlin's wave function by decomposing the boson into a product of two fermions, B and B1, B2. And right, the boson wave function is a product of the two determinants, determinant 1 times determinant 2 for these two fermionic partons. And to get Laughlin wave function, all we have to do is put D1 and D2 into the lowest lambda level. And the lowest lambda level determinants, or van der Waal determinants, is just Zi minus Ej to the first power. And so, trivially, the Gutzwiller wave function, which we get for the boson, is just to take a product of these two van der Waal determinants, identifying the coordinates of the particles in the two van der Waal determinants. And so that's a square of the lambda level determinant, and it's just Zi minus Ej squared. Okay, so we recover nu equals 1/2 Laughlin state for bosons. And in fact, I was having discussions last week, and I guess it was you, John, and that convincing me that in the quantum Hall effect, you should always use partons and never use Chern-Simons, right? And maybe not only not in the quantum Hall effect, in other problems, perhaps. So in the quantum Hall effect, one gets this composite Fermi liquid wave function via an all-fermionic decomposition of the electron. The electron is written times the boson times this fermion. Boson is next decomposed into a D1, D2, so C is D1, D2F. And the wave function is composite Fermi liquid wave function is the product of three determinants, det 1, det 2, det F, which just gives one the composite Fermi liquid wave function, Zi minus Ej squared times this Fermi C determinant.
Sure.
Okay, so wave functions are D-wave Bose-Metal that Lasik, Marcinich, and I were playing around with 5 years ago. We were really trying to, follow Laughlin in this case. So we said, well, let's just write B as D1, D2. So Laughlin was just a square of a van der Waal determinant for nu equals 1/2 bosons. And the van der Waal determinant has P plus IP, two-body correlations, and you square the wave function, you get d plus id. It's gone from 1 unit of angular momentum to 2 units of angular momentum. So the first thing we did is try squaring a Fermi C determinant. You just take a circular Fermi C determinant and you square it. This is really taking something which is P wave and getting something which is S wave. So it's like 1 plus 1 makes 0, rather than 1 plus 1 makes 2 in Laughlin. And indeed, if one takes this wave function for bosons, which is square of the Fermi C determinant, this is not the right thing to do. And in fact, this wave function has off-dying long-range order, which is kind of amusing. Numerically deduced. So it's a boson wave function describing a Bose condensate. And you can see that this wave function, because we've squared the Fermi determinant, has no non-trivial sign structure. It's everywhere non-negative. That's why it's the bosons are condensing. It's very difficult to write a wave function to stop bosons condensing if the wave function is non-negative, unless the bosons crystallize. They can break translational symmetry. Okay, so for the D-wave Bose-Metal, it then becomes clear what we want to try to do. We simply want to take a product of two Fermi C determinants elongated in the X or Y directions. So the wave function for this D-wave Bose-Metal is det X, elongating in the x direction and det y for the fermions elongating in the y direction. And if one plots the sine structure of this D wave Bose-Meadow wave function, you know, along the lines of David Sepperly, through every particle one has two lines, one coming from the first determinant, one coming from the second determinant. And since you've squashed the fermion determinants in these two different ways, the lines of the two determinants along preferentially along the x direction, preferentially along the y direction. I mean, occasionally they'll be one on top of another, but instead of measure zero. And so a typical configuration in this wave function is that that you have some particle, and when you take a test particle around, you have these two sets of nodal lines, and the wave function goes plus minus plus minus. So this is some sort of dxy, relative two particle correlations that one has built in.
If you just change the kx of the two standard terms, you still get longer.
When doing this slate particle or parton construction, as a question. No, I think you will. No, I think you will just have two Fermi surfaces. Yeah, I mean you will. Yeah, you won't. Well, okay, I see. So you take. I'm sorry, but then you have different number of particles, so you can't do the projection. Yeah. Yes, I should say that these the volumes inside these Fermi Cs are equal, and they're equal to the density of D1, which is equal to the density of D2, which is equal to the density of B.
Dumb question. How is it different from taking two free fermions and calling it a boson? I mean, you're doing more than that, obviously.
No, because what you're doing is...
you can vary it the same way, but it's... Yeah.
Well, okay, so you're writing... Okay, so you could say you have two species of fermions, and you write down the wave function, which is determinant, which depends on the coordinates of the R1, I mean, the first... flavor fermion, and then multiply by a determinant of R2. But what one's doing here is identifying R1 and R2.
But you can always ask, even if it's a two-flavor, you can always ask the local operator, which is the product of those two. I mean, what does it mean to identify them beyond that?
Well, it means in the wave function, you literally throw away all configurations of the wave functions unless every R1 particle.
It's a delta function on the
We're on a lattice. I think on a lattice here, actually. I mean, I probably, if you're not on a lattice, maybe a little dicey, but. Yeah, it's really a delta function. You're just gluing it on. I mean, and if you don't, the wave function is zero wave. Right? So it's a very strong perturbation. Oh, so that's the determinant of this. I mean, D1 and D2 may have bad notation here. It is, but it's just it's an elliptical.
You just scale the momentum.
Exactly. I'm just squashing one this way and squashing the other that way. Now, you guys should be able to squash space. There's no problem.
The minuses disappear.
As you go back to circular Fermi surfaces, the minuses disappear. Well, okay, so what happens is in just a single fermion determinant, you can ask, where there's just one nodal line passing through every fermion, you can ask what direction is it in. Well, if it's a circular Fermi surface, it's equal likely to be in any direction. And which direction it is in depends on the, in detail on the configurations of the nearby particles in some rather complicated way. So once one has slight ellipticity, one has distorted this, uniform distribution on the circle. For these directions of these nodal lines to point a little bit more towards the y direction, a little bit more towards the x direction.
So you can get a P wave thing if you just apply electric field to anything? You can just shift the center of both of those?
Well, it might shift both. I mean, and you want me to construct the state with a current?
Not really. No, maybe,
should
one little
bit
of
a
little
bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little bit of a little. Yeah, because that is just, it doesn't change the nodal structure except an overall phase factor, right? Just UVI.
So you can get a P wave thing if you just apply electric field to anything?
Pi k dot sum over all the coordinates. I would have to sit down. One might, it may be a trivial enough change that one can understand it. But I'm not sure. I mean, that could be that some weird, interesting state. Okay, so Hamiltonians for the 2D Bose metal, or a 2D Bose metal. So one might hope to have a continuum Hamiltonian. I mean, of course, in the ABS GFT, the simplest thing is to work in the continuum. And so here is a, you know, Lagrangian for interacting bosons of finite density. You know, I just have a complex field. It's non-relativistic finite chemical potential. There we go. But the ground state wave function for this Lagrangian will be nodeless. And most likely it will be a superfluid. It could in principle be a crystal. I mean, it could break translational symmetry in various ways. But you're not going to get a non-trivial sign structure from that theory. You're not going to be able to stop the bosons from condensing. And that's an issue. One thing one could do in the continuum, and this is where maybe the sum approach in the ABS, where one might be able to do something, is let me replace the partons with fundamental fermions. So, although maybe you guys never have fundamental fermions anyway. So, let me do that just conceptually here. It means they're gauge invariant. Yeah, exactly. So let me consider a spinful electron gas where the electrons can be in different places and there's no gauge fields. You know, it's, you know, a metal. I mean, and let me just take the upspin electrons and downspin electrons and, you know, argue they, or, you know, consider maybe in a cold atom context or something, that they have Fermi surfaces which are elliptical. So now these are really two flavors of particles, and there's you know, there's no projection going on. So the only thing I'm going to do now is I'm going to add an attractive interaction. So this is along the lines, I think, is maybe what Joe was thinking. I mean, you know, I can put in a short range, or, you know, a weak attractive interaction or a strong attractive interaction. And one would guess that the phase diagram, well, we don't really know, would look something like this as we increase the strength of the attractive interaction relative to the Fermi energy, that in the weak attractive interaction, one would have a metal because one has destroyed the BCS nesting. I mean, most of the upspin fermions at some particular momentum don't have a partner downspin fermion at the negative momentum. You know, so you really destroyed the BCS instability. On the other hand, if U is, you know, much bigger than EF, you're certainly going to pair, you know, these fermions, maybe probably make a molecule, and the molecule will condense, and you'll have a paired superfluid or a superconductor. But what about intermediate coupling? And this model might have an intermediate Bose metal type phase, in which the electrons have paired, and so there's a single electron gap, but the Cooper pairs have not condensed. And, you know, what's would be going on is that the electrons sort of inside a Cooper pair know about their Fermi surface structure still. And they would, you know, that would mess up the sign structure of the Cooper pair, which is trying to condense into a zero momentum state. This model you could talk about in the continuum. So, you know, so if one has a model, maybe an ADS CFT approach, where you have fermions which tend to, you know, which one of those, you know, which one of pair and condense, right? If there was some way to take the constituent fermions which are pairing and condensing and you know, distort their spaces so that one is stretched in, let's say, the X direction, another stretched in the Y direction, you'd have something potentially quite interesting. Well, I mean, you know, quite rich. We're running low on time, so let me just zip ahead. So lattice Hamiltonian for Bose metal. Get back to the lattice. We could consider the attractive U Hubbard model for fermions with anisotropic hopping. So basically, I'm just taking that model and sticking it on the lattice, and having the upspin fermion hop more easily in the x direction than the downspin fermion hop more easily in the y direction. And you know, from this model with interactive interaction, we can derive a boson model. We can hop one fermion and then hop the other. And that's equivalent to, of course, hopping a boson. Although we generate a boson hopping model for hardcore bosons in this limit that U is much bigger than T, this hopping strength is small parametrically in the anisotropy of the fermion hopping, which is epsilon, because you can't get them both hopping in the same direction very easily. Because one likes hopping, the upspin likes hopping in the x direction, and the downspin likes hopping in the y direction. But you can't generate a boson ring exchange. So here we have our Cooper pairs, if you will, made of two. And you can do this. You can undergo this boson ring exchange using the preferred strong hopping direction. So this parameter k, which is this boson ring exchange, is not parametrically small in this fermion anisotropy. And so one might expect that it would be important when the, or put it another way, if one takes this Hamiltonian and increases k, one would expect that the system would like to go into a Bose-Mellow state rather than a superfluid state. And the point is k, important point is k is positive, and that frustrates the condensation of bosons. It puts in negative signs into the boson wave function. There's no Marshall sign rule. There's no way to express the Hamiltonian in a local basis, which all off-diagonal elements of the Hamiltonian are negative. In that, so there isn't a wave function which is everywhere. The ground state wave function is not positive everywhere, or needn't be. And the phase diagram for k over j, presumably when k is small, it's a superfluid, and when k over j is large, it might be in this D-wave Bose metal. So this is just a boson model. So how can we access the...
what are these signs contoured?
Oh, you mean the sign of this sign here?
Yeah, it's not real. What?
No, it comes from the fact that is that this boson just is made of fermions rather than two bosons, right? So actually, if you look at this picture as you go down like this, you know, although you start here to reconstruct, you've actually done an exchange, and to get back to the same state, you have to do an exchange like this. So if you were doing this ring exchange with bosonic partons, this would be a minus sign. And we played with that model. Well, Dipri remembers that model with a minus sign there, and played with quite a bit, and it has some interesting properties. It doesn't have some of these properties that we'll see, but so there's a sign problem that, and that's probably as bad as it is for fermions and cannot be attacked with quantum Monte Carlo. What to do? Well, what we can do is notice the fact that there are Bose surfaces in this D-wave Bose metal. Within a mean field theory, is d1, d2, the mean field Green function factorizes, boson is d1 times d2 Green functions. In real space, you have to Fourier transform and get a convolution, and that's where you get these various surfaces, basically, when you convolve these. And one expects these singular lines in momentum space, these Bose surfaces, and this is where it's been very nice, learning about a lot of numerics, which allows one to access these Bose surfaces by working in positive one-dimensional system. The reason this works in this case is, imagine putting a two-dimensional Bose superfluid on an n-leg ladder. All the action is going on at zero momentum. That's where the condensation is going on. And so there's only one singular point, if you will. But if you put a D-wave Bose metal, which has a Bose surface on the ladder, then you get a whole slew of one-dimensional Bose points. That is many gapless 1D modes, one for each Bose point. So you can already see signatures of the two-dimensional Bose surface just by looking, in fact, at the two-leg ladder. Because that's really the basic difference between bosons and fermions. In one strictly one-dimension, tight binding model, we know that bosons and fermions are the same. But on the two-leg ladder, bosons and fermions are very different. Fermions have two bands, and you would fill up partially both of them, let's say. Whereas bosons don't. They just condense into the zero momentum state, or, you know, essentially try to condense, quasi-condense. So they just have one mode. So we spent a lot of time, very nice collaborators, looking at the boson ring model in the 2- and 4-leg ladders. I want to make this story kind of short. The bottom line is that as we increase the ratio of K over J, we go from a phase which is a superfluid, which is what one expects, to a phase which we identify as this D-wave Bose metal. And we see that on the 2-leg ladder, and we see it on the 4-leg ladder, this green region. And so the D-wave Bose metal occupies a large region of the phase diagram. And the physics of these phases and the correlation functions are very, very different. So that here is the superfluid, here's Bose metal. So this is what maybe David was expecting in a superfluid. At zero momentum, there's a quasi-condensate. But notice that this is only also at ky equals 0. It's a 2-leg ladder. And at ky equals pi, there's nothing going on. It's completely smooth. And that, you know, we understand that. That's because the boson is trying to condense into a two-dimensional superfluid state, which is only at zero wave vector, I mean zero momentum. And then here is the density-density correlation function. Whereas in the D-wave Bose metal, one gets these strange singular peaks away from a zero momentum. But moreover, and perhaps more important, is one has the singular structure at both qy equals 0 and qy equals pi. You know, so that's more like a fermion system, where one has two bands, right? Has a singular surface in the band 1 at qy equals 0 and band 2 at qy equals pi. And this is the same thing on the 4-leg ladder. Sorry, Ryan, I have to skip ahead in your next data. We can look at the variation of wave functions, I mean, these parton constructions. I just want to make one point here before going the last 5 or 10 minutes on electrons. You can ask, how good are these variational wave functions? And these variational wave functions are just are constructed on the 2-leg ladder by making a product of two determinants, determinant D1, determinant D2. At the filling we're at, we choose to fill the D2 band, only one band in D2, halfway filled, partially filled. And the D1 band, which hops more along the y direction, we fill both the bonding and the antibonding band. Okay, so the basic variational parameter, essentially the only variational parameter, is how many fermions we put in the antibonding bands how many of these D1 fermions we put in the antibonding band. So there's one variational parameter, and that variational parameter is determined by minimizing the energy of this ring Hamiltonian, this boson ring Hamiltonian on the 2-leg ladder. And then once one has that wave function, the boson momentum distribution function is computed with variation of Monte Carlo. And what's shown here is then what I showed before, but I didn't emphasize, is that there are actually four curves. There's two, there's a red and a blue, and then there are the dotted points. And actually, I don't even know which are which. But two of those are the exact results with DMRG, essentially exact. And two of those curves, or I guess the dotted ones, are from variation of Monte Carlo. And the remarkable thing is not that they look pretty similar to one another. The remarkable thing is that they have singular peaks at exact same momenta. And you know, the system is, I forget how long it is actually, but it's probably like 24 or 48. And so their momenta, the singular momentum, usually align with one another in one part in 50. So in other words, you know, what one has here is a solution of this ring Hamiltonian with DMRG, which has these singular peaks. And a variational wave function built of product of two fermion determinants, where you've minimized the energy over the shapes of the Fermi C's, and it chooses the Fermi wave vectors, you know, to one part in 50 to agree with the actual ground state of that Hamiltonian. I mean, I just, you know, frankly, I was blown away. I mean, I wasn't a believer in partons until that, really. You know, what is this breaking apart of particle into two? I mean, it's kind of nonsensical. Okay, so let me just, if I can just stay 10 more minutes, is it okay? So let me finish with coming back to the metal, the D-wave metal. Okay, so looking for non-fermion liquid phase of two-dimensional electrons, and I already mentioned this all-fermionic Hartree construction. C is VF, and B is D, okay, I'm calling it DX, DY. So C is DX, DY, F. And the wave function is a product of actually four determinants. There's the fermion determinant for DX, elliptical fermion determinant for DY, and then we have two spin species, and each has a determinant, the upspin electrons and downspin electrons. Okay, and we can use variational Monte Carlo to extract equal time correlation functions. But let's construct a Hamiltonian. Well, it's possible to construct a Hamiltonian pretty much the same way I did with this Hubbard model with attractive interactions. So maybe a little bit easier to think about it, or maybe not. But starting with this parton decomposition, writing down a lattice gauge theory, which in its strongly confined phase gives the electron, and there'll be two U1 gauge fields. And then in that strongly confined phase, integrate out the partons, integrate out the gauge field, and one then ends up with an electron Hamiltonian, and here's the electron Hamiltonian one ends up with. Think of it's like a TJ Hamiltonian, so this is the T, but rather than a J, we have a K. We could add a J in there as well, of course. And this K term, it's a ring exchange. What it does is it takes, it acts on four sites, and it is non-zero on this four-site state when two sites empty and the other two sites have two electrons which are in a singlet. And then the effect is to rotate that singlet. If these two electrons are in a triplet, this term annihilates that. So what this singlet rotation term likes doing is putting in a D-wave singlet two-particle correlations. You should think about it as getting, you know, pairs of electrons spinning around one another. It doesn't like to condense them because it's not moving them. It's just getting them spinning, putting them into an angular momentum state. Well, actually, you can generate an infinite U, basically, because of a fermion. Oh, I know, because of the dx and dy are spinless fermions, and so, yeah. You would generate some second neighbor hopping and probably near neighbor interaction. Yeah, so we're selecting out the term which gets large when we make the anisotropy of these two Fermi surfaces large. Right? It's the term which is not, you know, parametrically small in that anisotropy. We're selecting. I mean, at some point, I could talk with you about, you know, where this term could come from more microscopically. I mean, it's not entirely crazy to think about.
White and I found the same thing in a TJ model of a platter.
Okay.
I preferred to set up singlet pairs just as you have them with two holes at 4 and 2. And then it loved to make that, it favored making the transition there.
And that's the model that went straight from an anti-ferromagnet to a D-wave superconductor?
You have to be careful somehow. In the ladders, we could never get to do that. It never would go. We would never develop long-range D-wave pair correlations. We couldn't get it to do that.
So it looked like an anti-ferromagnet, did it mostly?
Neither. It was doped.
Oh, it was doped. I see. That would be really fun to talk about that in the two-leg ladders, especially. You can tell me if it's similar to what we're finding here. Just wrap up. So what about the phase diagram of this electron TK Hamiltonian? Again, the severe sign problem, intractable. We can go on to ladders. And you could say, is it possible to identify a non-Fermi liquid on a two-leg ladder? So interacting fermions in 1D is a Luttinger liquid. And the momentum distribution function looks like this, which is with a singularity alpha. And that singularity satisfies Leminger sum rule. I mean, this is certainly what I'm saying is true when the interactions are weak, certainly, in 1D. And so on a two-leg ladder, if the interactions are weak, you will have the electromomentum distribution functions in the ky equals 0, namely the first band, and ky equals pi, the second band, will both look something like this, and they will have singularities at kf0 and kf pi. And those two momenta, which measure all the particles inside the Fermi C, will add up to the Leninger volume. So a weakly interacting Leninger liquid on a two-leg ladder satisfies Leninger's theorem. With strong interactions, and you not. I mean, there's, I can talk about that. But basically, weak interactions, you know, a Leninger liquid is sort of morally a Fermi liquid in the sense that it has one of the features of a of the Fermi liquid, one of the two. It doesn't have a jump in the momentum distribution function, but it does have a, you know, a dominant singularity of the momentum distribution function, which does sum up to the Leninger volume, you know, the total number of fermions. Okay, so finally, let me just show you some of the data on the electron TK model on the two-leg ladder. Okay, where okay, so this is the ground state energy as a function of the ratio of K over T. The only point to take from this is that we seem to find three phases, small K over T, intermediate, and large K over T. The small K over T, you know, the interactions are weak, the weakest. You still have the infinite U, but and we find something completely consistent with the Leninger liquid. So this is DMRG data, momentum distribution function. There's no, essentially no fermions or no fermions in the second band at ky equals pi, and at ky equals zero band, we get, you know, very sharp, actually still Fermi surface, and you can count the number of fermions here, and it satisfies the Leninger sum rule. Right? So that's it's a Leninger liquid, but it's morally a Fermi liquid. Now, in this intermediate value of K over T, we get a trivial state, spin polarized. I want to skip on that. So it's larger value of K over T, we get this for the electron momentum distribution function. And, you know, this, I don't know, have you ever seen something like this for electrons? I certainly haven't. And you might say, well, maybe you've got a, you know, Fermi surface here, and so this is the volume, number of particles. I'm not sure whether it's what you'd want to do with this ky equals pi. But when you vary parameters around, so you increase K over T and do something like that. So you know, it has no sign of Leninger's volume anymore. It's just completely gone. You know, can we understand that? Well, you know, these are just DMRG results. And the only way to understand these things, these states, is with these variational wave functions, I think, and the parton approach. And so we're just going to employ the parton construction. We have dx, dy, and f. Two bands partially filled for dx, one band for dy, and one band for the spinons. And we're just going to multiply those together. But let's ask about the electron momentum distribution function then. I mean, that was this very weird looking thing here.
Do you know the order of the phase transitions as you vary k?
As we vary k, they're pretty much first order, I think. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty strong first order transitions. I mean, in two dimensions, I don't see why they would be, but on these ladders, they seem to be. The electron momentum distribution function, within mean field theory, you want to take a convolution of the partons. The electron momentum distribution function of the electron is dx, dy, f. Now, when you look at the gauge theory, you see that certain wave vectors are enhanced. And I mean, I didn't detail that, but with the bosonic ring model, in mean field theory, you'd say that the boson momentum distribution function is dx, dy momentum distribution functions. But that would predict more singular features than you actually see in the mean field theory. With the gauge theory, basically the gauge theory tells you which dx and dy fermion are trying to bind together and condense as a boson. I mean, and in fact, the rule of thumb is Ampere's law. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing. You know, I've been thinking about this for a number of years, and then Patrick Lee said, well, it's just Ampere's law. Which is, if you have these partons, let's say dx and dy partons, and they And, oh, what am I doing here? Yeah, so it turns out that the, so if you have a right-moving dx parton and a left-moving dy parton, the dx parton has gauge charge 1, and the dy parton has gauge charge minus 1. And so the right-moving dx parton and the left-moving dy parton have currents which are parallel to one another, the gauge currents. And when you have two fermions with parallel currents, they try to, they're tracked, two wires are tracked. And they like to try to almost form a bound state, and they make a boson which is almost condensed. And that gives you the singular peak. I mean, it's quite curious. I mean, that's responsible, gives you the location of this peak. And there are other peaks where they're moving in both in the same direction, which you don't see. Right, so yeah, so the gauge theory gives you some intuition for what the Goetz-Wooler projection and what the DMRG do. Okay, but so, okay, so very briefly, so then the very sharp peaks in the exact boson momentum distribution function, which we have, so what we can do as by way of approximation is what I'm going to do is replace the boson momentum distribution function, and this is just to get some intuition. I'm going to replace these sharp peaks by delta functions, okay, approximately. And then I'm going to say the electromomentum distribution function is approximately the convolution of this approximate boson momentum distribution function and free fermions. So I'm going to say that the spinons are in a free fermionicity. And, you know, so what we're doing is convolving these delta functions with a filled free fermionicity. And what you get is you get these two pictures. Okay, it comes along and it's up, and it comes along and it's down. And then, that's, basically what one's seeing. I mean, it's, so it's like the boson has, almost condensed at these some incommensurate wave vectors, and the fermions are just being free fermions. I mean, it, next.
Are you also using Ampere's law here?
Yeah.
When you select how you.
Yeah, I mean, there's more possibilities though, and there's, I mean, when you can actually use Luddinger liquid to, I mean, you can bosonize the gauge theory, use Luddinger liquid theory, and it does a little bit better than Ampere's law, as it has you have Luddinger liquid exponents, which tell you. And all the singular features we see are the ones that are enhanced. We don't know which. There are some enhanced ones which you don't see so much. I mean, one has to really get in there and look in detail. It's not as clean. I mean, the boson is just there's one wave vector you expect. But, I mean, I'm just, Yeah, but I mean, it's because you can add a left mover and a right mover, but then do you add a right or left moving fermion? And what if you add a right mover dx and a right mover dy, but a left moving fermion? I mean, there's two gauge fields, there's two charges, and
you're saying that the bosonic bound state is really not that strongly bound in some sense, and it's you really have to think about the constituents. Is that?
Well, I'm saying empirically. It actually seems like the bosons are a pretty good bound state. I mean, because this sort of argument does account for the main features, right? But one may not see that. I mean, but so these features satisfy Ampere's law, but there's other ones which, I mean, it's not a, you can't please everybody kind of thing. I mean, there's two types of gauge fields and there's gauge charges, and there's not one wave vector which makes everybody happy, makes both gauge fields happy, and so it's not quite so simple. Okay, I'll wrap up here. Oh, just to say, okay, variation of Monte Carlo. How does variation of Monte Carlo do? Pretty well, not as well as with the bosons. There aren't many parameters. It's again the how many dx partons one puts in the bonding band, and you can compare the ground state energies. DMRG versus VMC, which, it's okay, it's not great. But the VMC states, they look sort of roughly the same for the momentum distribution function. The locations of these peaks, we might be off by one momentum spacing, 2 pi over L. But what's cute about the VMC is we can just vary things around easily. And look at how these evolve, these momentum distribution functions. Yeah. How would you like electrons doing that? I mean, that's pretty bizarre. But, and then, well, here's a, we're trying to compare VMC versus DMRG. And, you know, there's a lot of curves. I mean, a lot of the single features are in the right place. You have to really get in there and look at it. You know, it's doing fairly well. It's doing well enough for us to believe that, you know, we understand the essence of this D-wave metal on the Soulaig ladder. I mean, you know, we don't have an exact wave function. The DMRG gives us exact results, of course, but the VMC doesn't. And so here this looks better, the density-density structure factor and the spin structure factor. Well, so let me just wrap up then. I guess I want to summarize. I just mentioned a few things that you know, that one might want to, we might want to look at, or other people might want to look at. I don't know. So in these ladder models, what hasn't been done very much is entanglement entropy, in particular with variational wave functions, and that's something that a couple of students here, Jim Garrison and Ryan, I think, are looking at. With DMRG, one could do dynamics. I mean, it'd be interesting to see, you know, some of the gapless modes that are present in these states. I mean, these wave functions, and I mean, everything I've shown is equal time correlation functions, right? And the wave functions only give you equal time correlation functions, and DMRG, basically, its simplest guys only gives you equal time correlation functions, but there is these dynamical DMRGs where they can calculate spectra and, you know, spectral functions and finite frequency. And we really want to push up towards two dimensions. DMRG is, it's going to be problematic, but the variation of Monte Carlo, you can go up to two dimensions. And so we want to try to look at various wave functions and various Hamiltonians. But Fermi liquids, D-wave BCS superconductors, and maybe the D-wave metal thrown into the mix. And so, is Arun Paramakenti here? Hello, Arun. So, I mean, we are inspired by what you did, and you know, might want to try to extend it, and, you know, add an extra term to the Hamiltonian, this K term, and then consider we've got some extra classes of wave functions that one could look at as well, which may or may not be energetically competitive with, you know, with the Fermi liquid and the D-wave BCS state that you're looking at. Well, other wave functions and Hamiltonians for the 2D non-Fermi liquid phases. But the real issue here is that everything I've said and all the intuition that one has can garner is using this Hartong approach. And I mean, it's bizarre, it's amazing, it works so well. And it's using the, you know, it's a theoretical, it's something that's nice theoretically because, you know, free fermions and bosons we can understand, or free fermions we can understand. It says we'll just break everything into the fermions and use free fermions. And why should that work? I mean, maybe it doesn't, it probably, I mean, it won't always work, but it seems to work extremely well sometimes. I know when I talked to Sentil about this, he says, you know, he's been trying to get away from partons for, you know, 5 years. And it's not easy, but ADS-CFT is not partons, you know, I don't think. Well, maybe you can wrap, you can.
Just a question about what you're saying. I mean, you know, it seems like we rarely think that the right wave function would be a wave function in terms of approximately canonical weakly interacting partons. And so it's not surprising if sometimes you can get long distance behaviors right using a parton picture. But what's surprising is you even seem to get short distance structure of like momentum space occupation numbers, right?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, okay, so the location of the singular features in momentum space is a reflection of the sine structure in the ground state wave function. And in the energetics of these frustrated models, the sine structure is all important. And evidently, in these parton constructions breaking the boson in terms of two fermions, these two fermions, these product of determinants, has the ability to encode the correct, you know, almost correct sign structure. You're right, I mean, the amplitudes look awfully well, awfully good as well. And now you might say, well, why on earth is that? Well, I mean, I had these, you know, this demonstration of this sort of derivation of the ring exchange in terms of the, you know, the four fermions and hopping this way and hopping that way, and saying, you know, when the Fermi surface, when take the gauge of when the fermionic partons are strongly anisotropic, there'll be a large ring exchange term when you integrate out the gauge field. So that, in some sense, that, you know, we derived from the gauge theory of the partons a boson or electron Hamiltonian, which, you know, had a good chance of maybe giving some of the right physics, because in the limit we were looking at of these anisotropic Fermi surfaces, there was one term which came out for the electron or boson Hamiltonian. Having said that, you know, we've done some other work where looking at electrons at half filling in a Mott insulator, I mean, it's essentially an antiferromagnet, spin a half antiferromagnet in a triangular lattice, and which Nail orders in just the nearest neighbor Heisenberg interaction. But you can then take and add a ring exchange interaction. Now, the ring exchange interaction one's adding there is very physical. If you think about the electrons, if you think about the underlying electrons in this Mott insulator, there are processes where four electrons literally, you know, start rotating around. And if you rewrite that process in terms of spin operators, you get this ring exchange term that people use, right, and that we use. And so we used that, and then we looked on two and four leg ladders, and the wave, and we got some exotic spin liquid phase, and the spin liquid phase was extremely well described by taking let's break the electron into, excuse me, the spin into the fermions, and I mean, imagine they're electrons. I mean, put the electrons into the triangular lattice nearest neighbor hopping Fermi C, and then get to the project. And just say whenever there's an upspin electron, there has to be a downspin. And I ran a half filling. And so, no, excuse me, whenever you can't have two electrons on top of each other, sorry. You just project into the spin subspace. It's the Gutzwiller projected Fermi C. It's the model which, you know, the gauge theoretic model, you know, that Joe and others have looked at is you know, fermions with the U1 gauge field. And so that, the Gutzwiller projected version of that field theory, you know, work amazingly well in capturing the exotic spin liquid phase that we are finding that occurs in the triangular lattice spin liquid when one puts in this ring exchange. And so the physics of this ring exchange is that it's almost like the, you know, there are electrons which are moving around. It's almost like it's not, you know, a weak Mott insulator. You're hardly in a Mott insulator. And then it's that these spin-ons that you might use are almost electrons. Right, so that is sort of a hand-waving reason why it might be the wave function might actually capture the physics of the model. But one doesn't always have that, and you know, when one doesn't, it doesn't always work. And then, and the other thing I should say is, I mean, you know, I've been focusing on these Bose metals and E-wave metals and so forth. The virtue of them is that they have multiple modes on ladders, because they have these Bose surfaces and Fermi surfaces. And so that they show up and you can get access to them in DMRG. Whereas if you have like a spin liquid which has relativistic physics, I mean, maybe it's a relativistic fermion minimally coupled to a gauge field, where the singular points are maybe at four places in the Brown zone, you put it on ladders, you quantize the transverse momentum, you'll miss them, most of them. You might hit one, but so you won't be able to easily approach a two-dimensional limit, right? So that's a problem. I mean, so some of the nice irony here is that the most complicated non-Fermi liquid phases are these, these Bose metal type phases, which have these singular surfaces. Those are the ones that you can access numerically with DMRG. Yeah.
So I kind of think you're underselling the part of construction. Do you know any example where you have a lattice gauge theory description of the parton model, where you can produce using the strength of the extension you described some electron Hamiltonian, where it fails? Where you have some reason to think that gauge theory has a decomplication? Do you know any example where you think it should work and it fails?
We try the ones we think are going to work. So the ones we... the places where the things don't necessarily work so well are with the spin models. You have a spin model and you write it in terms of, fermionic partons. And put the band, those fermions in a band structure like with Dirac fermions.
Well, but then there's the question of whether the gates are...
There is that question. You're right. Yeah.
Other than that, is there any way that it
works? Well, yeah, not that I know of, although if it doesn't work, people don't publish. there aren't that many cases which have been exhaustively looked at, and the ones that have been are the ones that are kind of working. Right, because you don't just... Yeah, it's hard, I shouldn't be so negative on partons. I've been wasting half my life.
With long-range interactions of the effective particles, it wouldn't work?
Depends, yeah.
Statistical interactions between them.
It's time reversal symmetry, whether it's preserved or not, right?
But you want just like Coulomb interactions or something in a...
Anything that doesn't short-range interactions, why would such a picture work very well?
Well, in quantum Hall space, for example, the conditions of the partons have statistical interactions.
But that's a fake, give you that
thing. No, because these partons, they're not behaving like they're sitting on top of one another. They're behaving like they're moving around.
But what if that space is a long wave function, it's the ground state for a very short-range interaction, but then you can get long-distance properties.
Well, you mean long distance
interaction
between the
electrons?
Yeah.
Oh. But you mean you mean like second or third neighbor on a lattice or something?
Yeah.
Well, the ring exchange is a four body. I think the long range Coulomb interaction probably don't matter so much. What's remarkable is in these non Fermi liquid phases, the non-trivial physics is already showing up on the scale of 2, 3, 4 lattice, interparticle spacings, because it's in the sine structure of the wave function on short scales, which tell one sort of the shape of the Fermi surface, the rough shape. To get the detailed, whether the detailed singularities in the Fermi surface are long distance behavior, but the sine structure is actually quite short scale. I think signs of wave functions are not things that are understood, really.
That's amazing. You get such good agreement
with
very
few parameters. Yeah, and that one parameter is determined energetically to minimize the Hamiltonian. So the wave function, it's not going to be that close to the actual ground state wave function, this variational wave function, but it has the right singular, it has the right sine structure. It does look pretty good. It looks pretty good. It's kind of amazing. I'm continually amazed that this stuff is working, that it gives one an intuition for what's going on.
You were saying that the exponent alpha depends on the direction in this... Do you think that's a feature of quasi-1D, that when it went to 2D it would become uniform at least for this?
I think in the gauge theory analysis, within the usual approximate approach, my recollection could be wrong, but I think that the exponents do depend on the direction because there's a dimensionless parameter which is the ratio of ratio of curvatures. Yeah, and they depend on that. Actually, yeah, they tell you how well nested.
Just in the sense that all numerics that you show it was for this quasi 1D system, right? And so now, what are the status of this in 2D? So, of the existence, so it's a sort of conjecture, that you could say, or you could say there are sort of kind of a very convincing argument that this space do exist in 2D, and say if I would ask about 3D, we all say that there are phases.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing really that one can do to really in two dimensions that with these Hamiltonians which have the sign problem is, you know, some variational Monte Carlo, right? And so there's Lazy Quantum Inch has done some variation of Monte Carlo for the two-dimensional boson ring model, comparing the energetics of the superfluid and the Bose metal. And there's regions of the phase diagram where the Bose metal wins energetically. But you know, the problem is when you do variation of wave functions, you know, no one believes you. And I usually don't believe them either. And so the best we can do here is we do the variation of wave functions against the DMRG and go as many ladders as we can, and then just, you know, if it's still working, then just say, well, we're going to now jump into no man's land and just work in two dimensions with the variation of wave functions and just plow out and do it. We haven't done that yet. Trying to be conservative.